from quite close to where the Stad family had lived not so long ago.
"Come," Anders Pena growled. "But it better be damned good, Arlen."
Arlen had aged in the years since Beeson had appeared at Pena's door with Peter's note. The changes in him, however, were slight when compared with the changes in Pena. The former judge general's hair was almost all gone. His spareness of frame had become gauntness. The loss of hair and weight were very little, however, when compared with the changes in his face. Formerly he had been stern. Now he was grim. Dark brown hollows floated below his eyes. The stamp of despair was clear on his face, and there was good reason for this. He had seen the things he had spent his life defending brought to ruin, and this ruin had been accomplished with shocking ease, and in a shockingly brief period of time. Oh, I suppose all men of intelligence know how fragile such things as law and justice and civilization really are, but it's not a thing they think of willingly, because it disturbs one's rest and plays hob with one's appetite. Seeing his life's work knocked casually apart like a child's tower of blocks was bad enough, but there was another thing which had haunted Pena these last 4 years, something that was even worse. This was the knowledge that Flagg had not achieved all the dark changes in Delane alone. Pena had helped him. For who else had seen Peter brought to a trial which was perhaps too speedy? Who else had been so convinced of Peter's guilt, and not so much by the evidence as by a young boy's shocked tears? Since the day Peter had been led to the top of the Needle, the chopping block in the plaza of the Needle had been stained a sinister rusty color. Not even the hardest rain could wash it clean, and Pena thought he could detect that sinister red stain spreading out from the block, spreading out to cover the plaza, the market streets, the alleys. In his troubled dreams, Pena saw rills of fresh blood washing in bright, accusing threads between the cobblestones and running down the gutters in streamlets. He saw the bedans of Castle Delane gleaming bloody in the sun. He saw the carp in the moat floating belly up, poisoned by the blood which poured out of the sewers in floods, and which rose from the springs in the earth itself. He saw the blood rising everywhere, staining the fields and forests. In these unhappy dreams even the sun began to look like a bloodshot, dying eye. Flagg had let him live. In the mead houses people whispered behind their hands that he had reached an agreement with the magician, that he had perhaps given Flagg the names of certain traitors, or that perhaps Pena had something on Flagg, some secret that would come out if Pena died suddenly. This was, of course, ridiculous. Flagg was not a man to be threatened, not by Pena, not by anyone. There were no secrets. There had been no agreements or deals. Flagg had simply let him live, and Pena knew why. Dead, he would perhaps have been at peace. Alive, he was left to twist on the rack of his own bad conscience. He was left to watch the terrible changes Flagg had wrought on Delane.
"Well?" he asked irritably. "What is it, Arlen?"
"A boy has come, my lord. He says he must see you."
"Send him away,"
Pena said moodily. He reflected that even a year ago he would have heard a knock at the front door, but it seemed that he became more deaf with every passing day.
"I see no one after nine, you know that. Much has changed, but not that."
Arlen cleared his throat.
I know the boy. It is Dennis, son of Brandon. It is the king's butler who calls."
Pena stared at Arlen, hardly believing what he had heard. Perhaps he was growing deaf even faster than he had thought. He asked Arlen to repeat, and it came out sounding just the same.
"I'll see him. Send him in." "Very good, my lord."
Arlen turned to leave. The similarity to the night Beeson had come with Peter's note, even down to the cold wind screaming outside, came strongly to Pena now.
"Arlen!"
he called. Arlen turned back.
"My lord."
The right corner of Pena's mouth quirked the smallest bit.
"Are you quite sure it's not a dwarf boy?"
"Quite sure, my lord,"
Arlen replied, and the left corner of his own mouth twitched the tiniest bit.
"There are no dwarves left in the known world, or so my mother told me."
"Obviously she was a woman of good sense and clear discernment, dedicated to raising her son properly, and not to be held responsible for any inherent flaws in the material she had to work with. Bring the boy here directly."
"Yes, my lord."
The door closed. Pena looked into his fire again and rubbed his old, arthritis-crippled hands together in a gesture of unaccustomed agitation. Thomas's butler. Here. Now. Why? But there was no sense in speculating. The door would open in a moment, and the answer would come walking through it in the form of a man-boy who would be shaking with the cold, perhaps even frostbitten. Dennis would have found it a good deal easier to reach Pena if Pena had still been at his fine house in the castle city, but his house had been sold from beneath him for unpaid taxes following his resignation. Only the few hundred guilders he had put away over the course of 40 years had allowed him to buy this small, drafty farmhouse and continue to pay Beeson. It was technically in the inner baronies, but he was still many miles west of the castle, and the weather had been very cold. In the hallway beyond the door, he heard the murmur of approaching voices. Now the answer would come through the door. Suddenly, that absurd feeling, that feeling of hope, like a ray of strong light shining in a dark cave, came back to him. Now the answer will come through the door, he thought, and for a moment he found himself believing that was really true. As he drew his favorite pipe from the rack beside him, Anders Pena saw that his hands were trembling. The boy was really a man, but Arlen's use of the word was not unjustified, at least not on this night. He was cold, Pena saw, but he also knew that the cold alone does not make anyone shudder as Dennis was shuddering. "Dennis!" Pena said, sitting forward sharply, and ignoring the twinge in his back the sudden movement caused. "Has something happened to the king?" Dreadful images, awful possibilities, suddenly filled Pena's old head. The king dead, either from too much wine or possibly by his own hand. Everyone in Delane knew that the young king was deeply moody.
"No. That is, yes, but no, not the way you mean, the way I think you mean."
"Come in here close to the fire," Pena snapped. "Arlen, don't just stand there gawking. Get a blanket. Get two. Wrap this boy up before he shakes himself to death like a buggerlug bug."
"Yes, my lord,"
Arlen said. He had never gawked in his life. He knew it, and Pena did too, but he recognized the gravity of this situation and left quickly. He stripped the two blankets from his own bed. The only other two in this glorified peasant's hut were the ones on Pena's, and brought them back. He took them to where Dennis crouched as close to the fire as he could without bursting into flames. The deep frost which had covered his hair had begun to melt and to run down his cheeks like tears. Dennis wrapped himself in the blankets.
"Now, tea. Strong tea. A cup for me, a pot for the boy."
"My lord, we only have half a canister left in the hall."
"Bugger how much we have left! A cup for me, a pot for the boy!"
He considered.
"And make a cup for yourself, Arlen, and then come in here and listen."
"My lord?"
Even all of his breeding could not keep Arlen from looking frankly astounded at this.
"Damn!" Pena roared. "Would you have me believe you're as deaf as I've become? Get about it!"
"Yes, my lord,"
Arlen said, and went to brew the last tea in the house. 83. Pena had not forgotten everything he had ever known about the fine art of questioning. In point of fact, he had forgotten damned little of that, or anything else. He had had long sleepless nights when he wished that he could forget some things. While Arlen made the tea, Pena went about the task of putting this frightened— no, this terrified young man at his ease. He asked after Dennis's mum. He asked if the drainage problems which had so plagued the castle of late had improved. He asked Dennis's opinion on the spring plantings. He steered clear of any and all subjects which might be dangerous, and little by little, as he warmed, Dennis calmed. When Arlen served the tea, hot and strong and steaming, Dennis slurped half the cup at a gulp, grimaced, then slurped the rest. Impassive as ever, Arlen poured more.
"Easy, my lad," Pena said, lighting his pipe at last. "Easy's the word for hot tea and skittish horses."
"Cold. Thought I was going to freeze coming out here."
"You walked?"
Pena was unable to conceal his surprise.
"Yes. Had my mother leave word with the lesser servants that I was home with the grip. That'll hold all for a few days, it being so catching this time of year. Or should do. Walked. Whole way. Didn't dare ask a ride. Didn't want to be remembered. Didn't know it was quite this far. If I'd known, I might have taken a ride after all. I left at 3 o'clock.
He struggled, his throat working, and then burst out.
And I'm not going back, not ever. I seen the way he looks at me since he come back, narrow and on the side, his eyes all dark. He never used to look at me that way, never used to look at me at all. He knows I seen something, knows I heard something. He don't know what, but he knows there's something. He hears it in my head like I'd hear the bell ringing out from the Church of the Great Gods. If I stay, he'll get it out of me. I know he will.
Pena stared at the boy under furrowed brows, trying to sort out this amazing flood of declaration. Tears were standing in Dennis's eyes.
I mean,
softly, Dennis, Pena said. His voice was mild, but his eyes were not. I know who you mean. Best not to speak his name aloud. Dennis looked at him with dumb, simple gratitude. You'd better tell me what you came to say, Pena told him.
Yes. Yes, all right.
Dennis hesitated for a moment, trying to get himself under control and to arrange his thoughts. Pena waited impassively, trying to control his rising excitement.
You see, Dennis began at last, 3 nights ago, Thomas called me to come and stay with him, as he sometimes does, and at midnight or sometime thereabouts.
84. Dennis told what you have already heard, and to his credit he did not try to lie about his own terror or gloss it over. As he spoke, the wind whined outside, and as the fire burned low, Pena's eyes burned hotter and hotter. Here, he thought, were worse things than he ever could have imagined. Not only had Peter poisoned the king, Thomas had seen it happen. No wonder the boy king was so often moody and depressed. Perhaps the rumors that passed in the mead houses, rumors that had Thomas more than half mad already, were not so far-fetched as Pena had thought. But as Dennis paused to drink more tea, Arlen refilled his cup from the bitter lees of the pot, Pena drew back from that idea. If Thomas had witnessed Peter poisoning Roland, why was Dennis here now, and in such deadly terror of Flag? You heard more, Pena said.
I, my Lord Judge General, Dennis said. Thomas, he raved quite some time. We were closed up in the dark together long.
Dennis struggled to be clearer, but found no words to convey the horror of that closed-in passageway, with Thomas shrieking in the darkness before him and the dead king's few surviving dogs barking below them. No words to describe the smell of the place, a smell of secrets which had gone rancid like milk spilled in the dark. No words to tell of his growing fear that Thomas had gone mad while in the grip of his dream. He had screamed the name of the king's magician over and over again, had begged the king to look deep into the goblet and see the mouse that simultaneously burned and drowned in the wine. "Why do you stare at me so?" he had shrieked, and then, "I brought you a glass of wine, my king, to show you that I too love you." And finally he had shrieked out words that Peter himself would have recognized, words better than 400 years old. "'Twas Flag, Flag, 'twas Flag." Dennis reached for his cup, got it halfway to his mouth, and then dropped it. The cup shattered on the hearthstones. The three of them looked at the shards of crockery. "And then?" Pena asked in a deceptively gentle voice.
"Nothing, for a long, long time," Dennis said in a halting voice. "My eyes had gotten used to the darkness, and I could see him a little. He was asleep at those two little holes, with his chin on his breast and his eyes closed."
"And he remained so for how long?"
"My lord, I know not. The dogs had all quieted again, and perhaps I
"Dozed a bit yourself, I think it is likely, Dennis.
Then later, he seemed to wake. His eyes opened at any rate. He closed the little panels and all was dark again. I heard him moving and I drew my legs back so he would not trip over them. His nightshirt, it brushed my face."
Dennis grimaced as he remembered a feeling like cobwebs drawn in a whisper over his left cheek.
"I followed him. He let himself out. I followed still. He closed the door so that it looked like only plain stone wall again. He went back to his apartments, and I followed him."
Did you meet anyone?
Pena rapped so sharply that Dennis jumped.
Anyone at all?
No. No, my Lord Judge General, no one at all.
Ah. Pena relaxed. That is very well. And did anything else happen that night?
No, my lord. He went to bed and slept like a dead man.
Dennis hesitated and then added,
I didn't sleep a wink myself and haven't slept many since either.
And in the morning he...
remembered nothing.
Pena grunted. He steepled his fingers and looked at the dying fire through the little finger building he had built. And did you go back to that passageway? Curiously, Dennis asked,
Would you have gone back, my lord?
Yes, Pena said dryly. The question is, did you?
I did.
Of course you did. Were you seen?
No. A chambermaid passed me in the hallway. The laundry is down that way, I think. I smelled lye soap like my mum uses. When she was gone, I counted up 4 from the chipped stone and went in.
To see what Thomas had seen.
Aye, my lord.
And did you?
Aye, my lord.
And what was it? Pena asked, knowing. When you slid aside those panels, what did you see?
My lord, I saw King Roland's sitting room, Dennis said, with all them heads on the walls, and, my lord...
In spite of the heat of the dying fire, Dennis shuddered.
All of them heads, they seemed to be looking at me.
But there was one head you didn't see, Pena said.
No, my lord, I saw them.
Dennis stopped, eyes widening.
Niner!
He gasped.
The peepholes!
He stopped, his eyes now almost as big as saucers. Silence fell again inside. Outside, the winter wind moaned and whined, and miles away, Peter, rightful king of Delane, hunched over a tiny loom high in the sky and wove a rope almost too fine to see. At last, Pena fetched a deep sigh. Dennis was looking up at him from his place on the hearth pleadingly, hopefully, fearfully. Pena bent forward slowly and touched his shoulder. You did well to come here, Dennis, son of Brandon. You did well to make a reason for your absence, quite a plausible one, I think. You'll sleep here with us tonight in the attic under the eaves. It'll be cold, but I think you'll sleep better than you have of late. Am I wrong? Dennis shook his head slowly once, and a tear spilled from his right eye and ran slowly down his cheek. And your mum knows naught of your reason for needing to be away?
No.
Then the chances are very good she'll not be touched by it. Arlen will take you up. Those are his blankets, I think, and you'll have to return them, but there's straw above, and it's clean.
I'll sleep just as well with only one blanket, my lord,
Arlen said. Hush! Young blood runs hot even in its sleep, Arlen. Your blood has cooled, and you may want your blankets, in case dwarves and trolls come in your dreams. Arlen smiled a little. In the morning we'll talk more, Dennis, but you may not see your mum for a bit now. I must tell you that, although I suspect you already know it might not be healthy for you to go back to Delane by the look of you. Dennis tried to smile, but his eyes were shiny with fear.
I had thoughts of more than the grip when I came here, and that's the honest truth, but now I've put your own health in danger as well, haven't I?
Pena smiled dryly. I'm old, and Arlen is old. The health of the old is never very strong. Sometimes that makes them more careful than they should be, but sometimes it makes them dare much. Especially, he thought, if they have much to atone for. We'll speak more in the morning. In the meantime, you deserve your rest. Will you light his way upstairs, Arlen?
Yes, my lord.
And then come back to me.
Yes, my lord.
Arlen led the exhausted Dennis from the room, leaving Anders Pena to brood before his dying fire. '85. When Arlen came back, Pena said quietly, We have plans to make, Arlen, but perhaps you'll draw us a drop of wine. It would be well to wait until the boy is asleep.
My lord, he was asleep before his head touched the hay he had gathered for his pillow.
Very well. But draw us a drop of wine anyway.
A drop is all there is to draw, Arlen said.
Good. Then we'll not have to set out with big heads tomorrow, will we?
My lord?
Arlen, we leave here tomorrow, the 3 of us, for the north. I know it. You know it. Dennis says there's grip in Delane, and so there is. One who would grip us if he could anyway. We go for our health. Arlen nodded slowly. It would be a crime to leave that good wine behind us for the tax man, so we'll drink it, and then take ourselves off to bed.
As you say, my lord.
Pena's eyes glinted.
But before you go to bed, you'll mount to the attic and get the blanket you left with the boy against my strict and specific instructions.
Arlen gaped at Pena. Pena mocked his gape with uncanny aptness, and for the first and last time in his service as Pena's butler, Arlen laughed out loud.
86. Pena went to bed, but could not sleep. It wasn't the sound of the wind that kept him awake, but the sound of cold laughter coming from inside his own head. When he could stand that laughter no longer, he got up, went back into the sitting room, and sat before the cooling fireplace ashes, his white hair floating in small clouds over his skull. Unaware of his comic look, and if he had been aware of it, he would have been unmindful, he sat wrapped in his blankets like the oldest Indian in the universe and looked into the dead fire. "Pride goes before a fall," his mother had told him when he was a child, and Pena had understood that. "Pride's a joke that'll make the stranger inside you laugh sooner or later," she had also told him, and he hadn't understood that, but he did now. Tonight the stranger inside was laughing very hard indeed, too hard for him to be able to sleep, even though the next day was apt to be long and difficult. Pena was fully able to appreciate the irony of his position. All his life he had served the idea of the law. Ideas like prison break and armed rebellion horrified him. They still did, but certain truths had to be faced. That the machinery of revolt had come to exist in Delane, for instance. Pena knew that the nobles who had fled to the north called themselves exiles, but he also knew that they were edging ever closer to calling themselves rebels. And if he were to keep that revolt from happening, he might well have to use the machinery of rebellion to help a prisoner break out of the needle. That was the joke the stranger inside was laughing at, laughing too loudly for sleep to be even a remote possibility. Such actions as the ones he was now thinking about went against the grain of his whole life, but he would go ahead anyway, even if it killed him, which it just might. Peter had been falsely imprisoned. Delane's true king was not on the throne, but locked in a cold, two-room cell at the top of the needle, and if it took lawless forces to put things right again, so it must be, but...
The napkins, Pena muttered. His mind circled back to them and back to them. Before we resort to force of arms to free the rightful king and see him enthroned, the business of the napkins should be investigated. He'll have to be asked. Dennis, and the Stad boy, perhaps, I.
My lord? Arlen asked from behind him. Are you unwell?
Arlen had heard his master rise, as butlers almost always do.
I am unwell,
Pena agreed gloomily. But it's nothing my physician can fix, Arlen.
I'm sorry, my lord.
Pena turned to Arlen and fixed his bright, sunken eyes upon the butler. Before we become outlaws, I want to know why he asked for his mother's dollhouse and for napkins with his meals. 87.
Go back to the castle,
Dennis asked the next morning in a hoarse voice that was almost a whisper.
Go back to where he is.
If you feel you can't, I'll not press you, Pena said. But you know the castle well enough, I think, to stay out of his way. If, that is, you know a way to get in unnoticed. To be noticed would be bad. You look much too lively for a boy who is supposed to be homesick.
The day was cold and bright. The snow on the long, rolling hills of the inner baronies threw back a diamond dazzle, which made the eyes water before long. I'll probably be snowblind by noon, and it'll serve me right, Pena thought grumpily. The stranger inside seemed to find this prospect hilarious indeed. Castle Delane itself could be seen in the distance, blue and dreaming on the horizon, its walls and towers looking like an illustration in a book of fairy stories. Dennis, however, did not look like a young hero in search of adventure. His eyes were full of fear, and his face bore the expression of a man who has escaped from a den of lions, only to be told he's forgotten his lunch and must go back in and get it, even though he's lost his appetite.
"There might be a way to get in," he said. "But if he smells me, how I get in or where I hide won't matter. If he smells me, he'll run me down."
Pena nodded. He did not want to add to the boy's fear, but in this situation nothing less than the truth could serve them. "What you say is true."
"But you still ask me to go?"
"If you can, I still ask it." Over a meager breakfast, Pena had told Dennis what he wanted to know, and had suggested some ways Dennis might go about getting the information. Now Dennis shook his head, not in refusal, but in bewilderment.
"Napkins,"
he said. Pena nodded. "Napkins." Dennis's fearful eyes went back to that distant fairy tale castle, dreaming on the horizon.
"When he was dying, my da said if I ever saw a chance to do a service for my first master, I must do it. I thought I'd done it coming here. But if I must go back—"
Arlen, who had been busy closing up the house, now joined them. "Your house key, please, Arlen," Pena said. Arlen handed it to him, and Pena handed it to Dennis. "Arlen and I go north to join the—" Pena hesitated and cleared his throat. "The exiles," he finished. "I've given you Arlen's key to this house. When we reach their camp, I'll give mine to a fellow you know, if he be there. I think he will be."
"Who's that?"
Dennis asked.
"Ben Stad."
Sunshine broke on Dennis's gloomy face.
"Ben! Ben's with them!"
"I think he may be," Pena said. In truth, he knew perfectly well that the entire Stad family was with the exiles. He kept his ear firmly to the earth, and his ears had not grown so deaf that he was not able to hear many movements in the kingdom.
"And you'd send him down here?"
"If he'll come, aye, I mean to," Pena replied.
"To do what? My lord, I'm still not clear about that."
"Nor am I," Pena said, looking cross. He felt more than cross, he felt bewildered. "I've spent my whole life doing some things because they were logical and not doing others because they were not. I've seen what happens when people act on intuition or for illogical reasons. Sometimes the results are ludicrous and embarrassing. More often they are simply horrible. But here I am, just the same, behaving like a crack-brained crystal-gazer."
"I don't understand you, my lord."
"Neither do I, Dennis, neither do I. Do you know what day this is?" Dennis blinked at this sudden change in direction, but answered readily enough.
"Yes, Tuesday."
"Tuesday, good. Now I'm going to ask you a question that my cursed intuition tells me is very important. If you don't know the answer, even if you are not sure, for the gods' sake, say so. Are you ready for the question?"
"Yes, my lord,"
Dennis said, but he wasn't sure that he really was. Pena's piercing blue eyes under the wild tangle of his white brows had made him very nervous. The question was apt to be very difficult indeed.
"That is, I think so."
Pena asked his question, and Dennis relaxed. It didn't make much sense to him. It was only more nonsense about the napkins, as far as he could see, but at least he knew the answer and gave it. "You're sure?" Pena persisted.
"Yes, my lord."
"Good. Then here is what I want you to do." Pena spoke to Dennis for some time as the three of them stood in the chilly sunshine in front of the retirement cottage where the old judge would never come again. Dennis listened earnestly, and when Pena demanded that he repeat the instructions back, Dennis was able to do it quite neatly. "Good," Pena said. "Very, very good."
"I'm glad I've pleased you, sir."
"Nothing about this business pleases me, Dennis. Nothing at all. If Ben Stad is with those unfortunate outcasts in the far forests, I mean to send him away from relative safety and into danger, because he may be of some use to King Peter. I'm sending you back to the castle because my heart tells me there's something about those napkins he asked for, and the dollhouse, something. Sometimes I think I almost have it, and then it dances out of my grasp again. He did not ask for those things idly, Dennis. I'd wager my life on that, but I don't know." Pena abruptly slammed his fist down on his leg in frustration. "I am putting two fine young men into terrible danger, and my heart tells me I am doing the right thing, but I don't know why!" And inside the man who had in his heart once condemned a boy because of that boy's tears, the stranger laughed and laughed and laughed. '88. The two old men parted from Dennis. They shook hands all around. Then Dennis kissed the judge's ring, which bore the great seal of Delane on its face. Pena had given up his judge general's bench, but had not been able to part with the ring, which to him summed up all the goodness of the law. He knew he had made mistakes from time to time, but he had not allowed them to break his heart. Even over this last and greatest of mistakes, his heart did not break. He knew as well as we in our own world do that the road to hell is paved with good intentions, but he also knew that, for human beings, good intentions are sometimes all there are. Angels may be safe from damnation, but human beings are less fortunate things, and for them hell is always close. He protested Dennis's act of kissing his ring, but Dennis insisted. Then Arlen shook Dennis's hand and wished him speed of the gods. Smiling, but Pena could still see the fear lurking in Dennis's eyes, Dennis wished them the same. Then the young butler turned east, toward the castle, and the two old men headed west, toward the farmstead of one Charles Reachel. Reachel, who raised Anduin huskies for a living, paid the grinding taxes the king had imposed without complaint, and was thus considered loyal. But Pena knew that Reachel was sympathetic to the exiles encamped in the far forests, and had helped others reach them. Pena had never expected to need Reachel's services himself, but the time had come. The farmer's eldest daughter, Naomi, drove Pena and Arlen north on a sled pulled by 12 of the Dogger's strongest huskies. By Wednesday night, they reached the edge of the far forests. "How long to the camp of the exiles?" Pena asked Naomi that night. Naomi cast the thin, evil-smelling cigar she had been smoking into the fire.
"Two more days if the skies keep fair. Four more days if it snows, maybe never if it blizzards."
Pena turned in. He drifted off to sleep almost at once. Logic or illogic, he was sleeping better than he had in years. The weather kept clear the next day, and on Friday as well. At dusk of that day, the fourth since Pena and Arlen had parted from Dennis, they reached the small huddle of tents and makeshift wooden huts for which Flag had searched in vain.
"Ho! Who comes, and can you say the password?"
a voice called. It was strong, sturdy, cheerful, and unafraid. Pena recognized it.
"It's Naomi Reachel," the girl called, "and the password 2 weeks ago was triples. If it's not that now, Ben Stad, then put an arrow through me and I'll come back and haunt you."
Ben appeared from behind a rock, laughing.
"I'd not dare meet you as a ghost, Naomi. You're fearsome enough alive."
Ignoring this, she turned to Pena.
"We've come," she said.
"Yes," Pena said.
"So I see.
And I believe it's well that we have, because something tells me that time has grown short. Very short indeed." 89. Peter had the same feeling. By Sunday, 2 days after Pena and Arlen reached the camp of the exiles, his rope would still, by his calculations, finish up 30 feet short of the ground. This meant that when he dangled from the end of it with his arms fully extended, he would face a drop of at least 21 feet. He knew that he would be wiser by far to go on with his rope for another 4 months, even another 2. If he dropped from the rope, fell badly, and broke both of his legs so that the plaza guards found him groaning on the cobbles when they made their round of the clock, he would have wasted more than 4 years, simply because he did not have the patience to pursue his labor another 4 months. This was logic Pena could have appreciated, but Peter's feeling that he must now hurry was much stronger. Once Pena would have snorted at the idea that feelings could be more trustworthy than logic, but now he might have been less sure. Peter had been having a dream. For almost a week running now, it had played over and over, gradually becoming more distinct. In it, he saw Flag, bent over some bright and glowing object. It lit the magician's face a sickly greenish yellow. In this dream, there always came a point when Flag's eyes first widened, as if in surprise, and then narrowed to cruel slits. His brows pulled down, his forehead darkened, a grimace as bitter as a crescent moon twisted his mouth. In this expression, the dreaming Peter read one thing and one thing only: death. Flag said only one word as he leaned forward and blew upon the brightly glowing object, which whiffed out like a candle when the magician's breath touched it. Only one word, but one was enough. The word from Flag's mouth was Peter's own name, uttered in tones of angry discovery. The night before, Saturday night, there had been a fairy ring around the moon. The lesser warders thought it would soon snow. Examining the sky this afternoon, Peter knew they were right. It was his father who had taught Peter to read the weather, and standing at the window, Peter felt a pang of sadness and a renewed spark of cold, quiet anger, the need to make things right again. "I'll make my try under cover of darkness and under cover of storm," he thought. "There'll even be a bit of snow to cushion my fall." He had to grin at that idea. 3 inches of light, powdery snow between him and the cobbles would do precious little one way or the other. Either his perilously thin rope would hold, or it would break. Assuming it held, he would take the drop, and his legs would either take the impact, or they wouldn't.
"And if they do take it, where will you go on them?"
a little voice whispered.
"Any who might have shielded you or helped you, Ben Stodd, for instance, have long since been driven from the castle keep, from the very kingdom itself, for all you know."
He would trust to luck, then. King's luck. It was a thing his father had often talked about.
"There are lucky kings and unlucky. But you'll be your own king, and you'll have your own luck. Myself, I think you'll be very lucky."
He had been king of Delane, at least in his own heart, for 5 years now, and he thought his luck had been the kind which the Stodd family, with its famous bad luck, would have understood. But perhaps tonight would make up for all. His rope, his legs, his luck. Either all would hold or all would break, quite possibly at the same time. No matter. Poor as it had been, he would trust to his luck.
"Tonight,"
he murmured, turning from the window, but something happened at supper which changed his mind. It took Pena and Arlen all day Tuesday to make the 10 miles to the Reachel farm, and they were nearly done in when they arrived. Castle Delane was twice as far, but Dennis probably could have been knocking at the west gate, if he had actually been mad enough to do such a thing, by 2 that afternoon, in spite of his long walk the day before. Such is the difference, of course, between young men and old men. But what he could have done really didn't matter, because Pena had been very clear in his instructions, especially for a man who claimed not to have the slightest idea of what he was doing, and Dennis meant to follow them to the letter. As a result, it would be some time yet before he entered the castle. After covering not quite half the distance, he began to look for a place where he could hole up for the next few days. So far he had met no one on the road, but noon had passed and soon there would be people returning from the castle market. Dennis wanted no one to see him and mark him. He was, after all, supposed to be home, sick in bed. He did not have to look long before he found a place that suited him well enough. It was a deserted farmstead, once well kept, but now beginning to fall into ruin. Thanks to Thomas the tax-bringer, there were many such places on the roads leading to the castle keep. Dennis remained there until late Saturday afternoon, 4 days in all. Ben Stodd and Naomi were already on their way back from the far forests to Pena's farm by then, Naomi pushing her team of huskies for all they were worth. The knowledge would have eased Dennis a bit if he had known, but of course he did not, and he was lonely. There was no food at all upstairs, but in the cellar he found a few potatoes and a handful of turnips. He ate the potatoes. Dennis hated turnips, always had, and always would, using his knife to cut out the rotten places, which meant he cut away 3/4 of every potato. He was left with a handful of white globes the size of pigeons' eggs. He ate a few, looked toward the turnips in the vegetable bin, and sighed. Like them? He didn't. Or hate them? He did. He supposed he would be reduced to eating them by Friday or so. "If I'm hungry enough," Dennis thought hopefully, "maybe they'll taste good. Maybe I'll just gobble those old turnips up and beg for more." He finally did have to eat a number of them, although he managed to hold out until Saturday noon. By then, they actually had begun to look good, but as hungry as he was, they still tasted terrible. Dennis, who suspected the days ahead might be very hard, ate them anyway. 91. Dennis also found an old pair of snowshoes in the basement. The straps were far too large, but he had plenty of time to shorten them. The lacings had begun to rot, and there was nothing Dennis could do about that, but he thought they would serve the purpose. He wouldn't need them for long. He slept in the cellar, fearing surprise, but during the daylight hours of those 4 long days, Dennis spent most of his time in the parlor of the deserted farmstead, watching the traffic pass to and fro. What little there was began around 3 of the clock and had mostly ceased by 5 when early winter shadows began to cover the land. The parlor was a sad, empty place. Once it had been a cheery spot in which the family had gathered to discuss the day just done. Now it belonged only to the mice. And to Dennis, of course. Pena, after hearing Dennis declare that he could read and write pretty well for a fellow in service, and seeing him draw his great letters — this had been over breakfast on Tuesday, the last real meal Dennis had had since his own lunch on Monday, a meal he looked back on with understandable nostalgia — had provided him with several sheets of paper and a lead pencil. And during most of the hours he spent in the deserted house, Dennis labored earnestly over a note. He wrote, scratched out, rewrote, frowned horribly as he reread, scratched his head, resharpened his pencil with his knife, and wrote again. He was ashamed of his spelling and terrified he would forget some crucial thing Pena had told him to put in. There were several times when his poor frazzled brain could make no more progress, when he wished Pena had stayed up an hour longer on the night Dennis had come and written his own damned note, or called it aloud to Arlen. Most times, however, he was glad of the job. He had worked hard his whole life, and idleness made him nervous and uneasy. He would rather have worked his sturdy young man's body than his not-so-sturdy young man's brains, but work was work, and he was glad to have it. By Saturday noon, he had a letter he was pretty well satisfied with, which was good, since he had worked his way down to the final 2 sheets of notepaper. He looked at it with some admiration. It covered both sides of the paper, and was by far the longest thing he had ever written. He folded it to the size of a medicine tablet, and then peeked out the sitting-room window, waiting impatiently for it to be dark enough to leave. Peter saw the gathering clouds from his own poor sitting-room atop the needle, Dennis from the sitting-room of this deserted house. But both had been taught by their fathers, one a king and the other a butler to that king, to read the sky, and Dennis also thought there would be snow tomorrow. By 4, the long blue shadow of the house had begun to creep out from the foundations, and Dennis no longer felt so eager to go. It was danger ahead, deadly danger. He was to go where Flag was perhaps even now brooding long over his infernal magics, perhaps even now checking upon a certain sick butler. But how he felt did not really matter, and he knew it. The time had come to do his duty, and as every butler in his family line had done for centuries and centuries, Dennis would do his best. He left the house in the bleak sunset hour, donned the snowshoes, and struck off across the field on a direct line toward the castle keep. The idea of wolves occurred to his uneasy mind, and he could only hope there would be none, and if there were, that they would leave him alone. He hadn't the slightest idea that Peter had decided to make his dangerous escape attempt the following night, but like Pena, and Peter himself, he felt a need to hurry. It seemed to him that there were mackerel-scale clouds laid across his heart as well as the sky. As he trudged through the snow-desolate fields, Dennis's thoughts turned to how he might enter the castle without being seen and challenged. He thought he knew how it could be done, if that was Flag did not smell him. He had no more than thought the magician's name when a wolf howled somewhere out in the still white wastes, in a dark room below the castle. Flag's own sitting room, the magician sat bolt upright suddenly in his chair, where he had fallen asleep with a book of arcane lore open on his stomach.
"Who speaks the name of Flag?"
the magician whispered, and the two-headed parrot shrieked. Standing in the center of a long and desolate field of white, Dennis heard that voice, as dry and scabrous as a spider's scuttle in his own head. He paused, his breath indrawn and held. When he finally let it go, it plumed frosty from his mouth. He was cold all over, but hot drops of sweat stood out on his forehead. From his feet he heard dry snapping noises, pook, 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 as several of the snowshoes' rotted cross-lacings let go. The wolf howled in the silence. It was a hungry, heartless sound.
"No one,"
Flag muttered in the sitting room of his dark apartments. He was rarely sick, could remember being sick only 3 or 4 times in all of his long life, but he had caught a bad cold in the north, sleeping on the frozen ground, and although he was improving, he was still not well.
No one. A dream, that's all.
He took the book from his lap, closed it, and set it on a side table. The surface of this table had been handsomely dressed in human skin, and settled back in his chair. Soon he slept again. In the snowy fields west of the castle, Dennis slowly relaxed. A single drop of stinging sweat ran into his eye, and he wiped it away absently. He had thought of Flagg, and somehow Flagg had heard him. But now the dark shadow of the magician's thought had passed over him, as the shadow of a hawk may pass over a crouching rabbit. Dennis let out a long, shaky sigh. His legs felt weak. He would try, oh, with all his heart he would try, to think of the magician no more. But as the night came on and the moon with its ghostly fairy ring rose in the sky, that was a thing easier resolved upon than done. At 8 o'clock, Dennis left the fields and entered the king's preserves. He knew them well enough. He had been a squireen for Brandon when his da bottled the old king in the fields of the hunt, and Roland had come here often, even in his old age. Thomas came less often, but on the few occasions when the boy king did come, Dennis had, of course, been required to come with him. Soon he struck on a trail he knew, and just before midnight he reached the verge of this toy forest. He stood behind a tree, looking out at the castle wall. It was half a mile away, over open, snow-covered ground. The moon was still shining, and Dennis was all too aware of the sentries who walked the castle parapet. He would have to wait until Prince Ailan had driven his silvery chariot over the edge of the world before crossing that open space. Even then he would be horribly exposed. He had known from the first that this would be the riskiest part of the whole adventure. Parting from Pena and Arlan, with the good sun shining down, the risk had seemed acceptable. Now it seemed utterly mad. "Go back," a cowardly voice inside him begged. But Dennis knew he couldn't. His father had laid a charge on him, and if the gods meant him to die trying to fulfill it, then he would die. Faint and yet clear, like a voice heard in a dream, came the call of the crier, drifting out to him from the castle's central tower.
12 o'clock and all's well.
Nothing's well, Dennis thought miserably. Not one single thing. He drew his thin coat more tightly around him and began the long job of waiting down the moon. Eventually it left the sky, and Dennis knew he had to move. Time had grown short. He stood, said a brief prayer to his gods, and began to walk across the open space as rapidly as he could, expecting a hail of "Who goes there?" from the castle walls at every moment. The hail did not come. The clouds had thickened across the night sky. All below the castle wall was one dark shadow. In less than 10 minutes, Dennis had reached the edge of the moat. He sat on its low bank, the snow crunching under his bottom, and took the snowshoes off. He slid down onto the moat itself, which was frozen and covered with more snow. Dennis's thundering heart slowed down. He was in the shadow of the bulking castle wall now, and would not be seen unless a sentry happened to look straight down, and most probably not even then. Dennis was careful not to go all the way across the moat, not yet, because the ice close to the castle wall would be rotted and thin. He knew why this was so. The reason for the thin ice and the unpleasant smell here and the mossy wetness on the huge stones of the outer wall was his hope of entering the castle secretly. He moved carefully to the left, ears listening for the noise of running water. At last he heard it and looked up. There, at eye height, was a round black hole in the solid castle wall. Fluid ran from it in listless streams. It was a sewer outflow pipe.
"Now for it,"
Dennis muttered. He drew back 5 paces, ran, and leaped. As he did, he felt the ice, rotted by the constant outflow of warm waste from the pipe, give under his feet. Then he was clinging to the mossy lip of the pipe. It was slick, and he had to clutch hard to keep from falling. He pulled himself up, digging for purchase with his feet, and finally yanked himself inside. He paused for a moment, trying to get his breath back, then began to crawl along the pipe, which slanted steadily upward. He and several of his playmates had found these pipes when they were children and had been quickly warned off by their parents, partly because they might become lost, mostly because of the sewer rats. Still, Dennis thought he knew where he would come out. An hour later, in a deserted corridor of the castle's east wing, a sewer grating moved, was still, then moved again. It was shoved partway aside, and a few moments later a very dirty and very smelly butler named Dennis pulled himself out of a hole in the floor and lay panting on the cold cobbles. He could have used a longer rest, but someone might come along, even at this unearthly hour. So he replaced the grating and looked around. He did not recognize the hallway at once, but this in no way upset him. He started down it toward the T-intersection at the far end. At least, he reflected, there had been no rats in the warren of sewer pipes below the castle. That had been a great relief. He had been prepared for them, not just because of the gruesome tales his Da had told him, but because there had been rats on a few occasions when he and his mates had ventured with fearful screeches of laughter down into the pipes as children. The rats had been part of the scary dare-you adventure of it. Probably there were just a few mice, and your memories exaggerated them into rats, Dennis thought now. This was not the truth, but Dennis would never know it. His memory of the rats in the sewers was a true one. The pipes had been infested with great, disease-bearing rodents since time out of mind. It had only been for the last 5 years that they had ceased to teem in the sewers. They had been wiped out by Flag. The magician had rid himself of both a piece of stone and his own dagger by means of a sewer grating similar to the one from which Dennis had emerged on this early Sunday morning. He had rid himself of them, of course, because there were a few flecks of the deadly green dragon sand on each. The fumes from those few grains had killed the rats, burning many of them alive even as they paddled through the scummy water in the pipes, suffocating all the others before they could flee. 5 years later, the rats had still not come back, although most of the poisonous fumes had dissipated. Most, but not all. If Dennis had entered one of the sewer pipes a bit closer to Flag's apartments, he might well have died himself. Perhaps it was luck that saved him, or fate, or those gods he prayed to. I'll not take a stand on the matter. I tell tales, not tea leaves, and on the subject of Dennis's survival, I leave you to your own conclusions. '93. He reached the junction, peered around the corner, and saw a sleepy young guard of the watch passing farther up the way. Dennis pulled back. His heart was thumping hard again, but he was satisfied. He knew where he was. When he looked back, the guard was gone. Dennis moved quickly, up this corridor, down that flight of stairs across t'other gallery. He moved with speedy sure-footedness, for he had spent his whole life in the castle. He knew it well enough, certainly, to find his way from the east wing, where he had come out of the sewers, to the lower west wing, where the napkins were stored. But because he dared not be seen, not by anyone, Dennis went by the most obscure corridors he knew, and at the sound of every footfall, either real or imagined, and I do think quite a few of them were imagined, he withdrew into the nearest cranny or niche. In the end, it took him over an hour. He thought he had never been so hungry in his life.
"Never mind your cussed belly now, Dennis. Take care of your master first, your belly later."
He was standing far back in a shadowy doorway. Faintly, he heard the crier call 4 o'clock. He was about to move forward when slow, echoing footfalls came down the hallway, a clank of steel and scabbard, a creak of leather leggings. Dennis pushed himself farther back into the shadows, sweating. A guard of the watch paused just in front of the thinly shadowed doorway where Dennis hid. The fellow stood for a moment rooting in his nose with his little finger, and then leaned over to blow a stream of snot between his knuckles. Dennis could have reached out and touched him, had felt certain that any moment the guard would turn, his eyes would widen, he would draw his short sword, and that would be the end of Dennis, son of Brandon.
"Please," Dennis's frozen mind whispered, "please, oh please."
He could smell the guard, could smell the old wine and burned meat on his breath and the sour sweat coming out of his skin. The guard started to move on. Dennis began to relax. Then the guard stopped and began rooting in his nose again. Dennis could have screamed.
"I have a girl name of Marchi Marchi Melda,"
the guard began to sing in a low-pitched, droning voice, rooting in his nose all the while. He produced a large green something.
examined it thoughtfully, and flicked it onto the wall.
Splat! She's got a sister named Esmeralda. I would sail the seven seas just to kiss her dimply knees. Tutty sing, tay sing, tea, pass me a bucket of wine.
Something exceedingly horrible was now happening to Dennis. His nose had begun to itch and tickle in a way which was unmistakable. Very soon he would sneeze.
Go!
He screamed in his mind.
Oh, why don't you go, you stupid fool?
But the guard seemed to have no intentions of going. He had apparently struck a rich lode up in the left nostril, and he meant to mine it.
I have a girl named of Darche, Darche, Darla. She's got a sister named Red-Headed Carla. I would take 1,000 sips from her pretty, pretty lips. Tutty sing tay, sing tea, and pass me a bucket of wine.
I'll hit you over the head with a bucket of wine, you fool,
Dennis thought.
Move on!
The itch in his nose grew steadily worse, but he did not dare even touch it for fear the guard would see the movement from the corner of his eye. The guard frowned, bent over, blew his nose between his knuckles again, and finally moved on, still singing his droning song. He was barely out of sight before Dennis threw his arm over his own nose and mouth and sneezed into the crook of his elbow. He waited for the clash of metal as the guard drew his sword and whirled back, but the fellow was half asleep and still half drunk from whatever party he had been at before his tour of duty commenced. Once, Dennis knew, such a slovenly creature would have been quickly discovered and sent to the farthest reaches of the kingdom, but times had changed. There was a click of a latch, the squeak of hinges as a door was drawn open, and then it boomed closed, cutting off the guard's song just as he reached the chorus again. Dennis sagged back in his niche for a moment, eyes closed, cheeks and forehead on fire, his feet twin blocks of ice.
For a few minutes there I didn't think of my belly at all,
he thought, and then he had to slam both hands over his mouth to stifle a giggle. He peeked out of his hiding place, saw no one about, and moved to a doorway down the corridor and on his right. He knew this doorway very well, although the empty rocker and needlework case outside it were new to him. The door led to the room where all of those napkins had been stored since the time of Kyla the Good. It had never been locked before, and was not now. Old napkins were apparently not considered worth locking up. He peered inside, hoping that his answer to Pena's key question still held true. Standing there in the road on that bright morning 5 days ago, Pena had asked him this.
Do you know when they take fresh stores of napkins to the needle, Dennis?
This seemed like a simple question indeed to Dennis, but you may have noticed that all questions seem simple if you know the answers, and most horribly difficult if you don't. That Dennis knew the answer to this one was a testament to his honesty and honor, although those traits were so deeply ingrained in his character that he would have been surprised if someone had told him this. He had taken money, Anders Pena's money, in fact, from Ben Stodd to make sure those napkins were delivered. Only a guilder, true, but money was money and pay was pay. He had felt honor-bound to make sure, from time to time, that the service was continuing. He told Pena about the big storeroom. Pena was flabbergasted to hear of it, and how each Saturday night around 7 o'clock, a maid took 21 napkins, shook them, ironed them, folded them, and set them in a stack on a small wheeled cart. This cart stood just inside the room's doorway. Early on Sunday morning, at 6 o'clock, less than 2 hours from right now, a servant boy would pull the cart to the plaza of the needle. He would rap at the bolted door at the base of the ugly stone tower, and one of the lesser warders would pull the cart inside and place the napkins on a table, where they would be doled out meal by meal through the week. Pena had been satisfied. Dennis now hurried forward, feeling inside his shirt for the note he had written at the farmhouse. He had a bad moment or two when he couldn't find it, but then his fingers closed over it and he sighed with relief. It had only slipped a little to one side. He lifted the Sunday breakfast napkin. Sunday lunch. For a moment he almost passed over Sunday supper as well, and if he had done that, my tale would have had a very different ending. Better or worse, I cannot say, but surely different. In the end, however, Dennis decided 3 napkins deep was safe enough. He had found a pin in a crack between 2 boards in the farmhouse living room and had nipped it into 1 shoulder strap of the rough linsey camisole he wore as underwear,
and if he had been thinking a little better, he would have nipped the note to his underwear with it in the bargain and spared himself that bad moment. But as I may have told you, Dennis's brains were sometimes a little lacking. Now he retrieved the pin and carefully attached the note to an inner fold of the napkin.
Let it find you.